Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. We heard on Wednesday about some of the recipients of the 2016 World Food Prize Award. Festivities surrounding the event will continue today and through the weekend in Des Moines. Later in the show, we will discuss the issue of biofortification, or enhancing the nutritional content of a crop and how that impacts people in the third world. Cornelia Flora, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at ISU, will be with us for that conversation. For now, however, we have Kathy Hansen, Director of School, Community, and Media Relations for the Ames Community School District, who is a regular monthly guest on our program. Good to see you again, Kathy.
Good to be here again, Greta.
So, Kathy, we talked a little bit yesterday about a new initiative the school board is undertaking. And why don't you start there, and then we'll move into the community and communications piece that flows from that.
Well, I'll start with a caveat that this is very much a work in progress, but it's indicative, I believe, of where the district is in terms of recognizing what is accomplished recently and some of the work that has yet to be done. So the board is beginning to work on strategic goals that will help it define success in terms that are very localized for this school district, this community, and for our students, and then all of the supporting structures that go into making sure that the board is putting in place the resources, the staff, the support to reach those goals that help the students be successful on those terms.
Okay, well, that's a lot to comprehend. It's a kind of abstract for early in the morning. Can you break that down? What are some of the challenges that the district faces that the board is gearing up to address?
Well, you know, it is very abstract. Unless you're in the buildings and in the classrooms and seeing the students and putting a face to it and hearing their stories and the stories of the teachers who are doing the work and the support staff and the leaders and administrators who are helping them do that work. It is very abstract. But when you see one student who is overcoming something or excelling in something or just having that aha moment, it suddenly is very personal. So a lot of the time school districts are judged on standardized tests.
Yeah, that's a big one.
And that, you know, is a snapshot in time. And if I were to take a test this morning at this hour, I might do very differently than I would at noon or on another day when I have more sleep or when I didn't have something at home that disrupted my ability to concentrate. So what we are trying to do as a district is take a really thoughtful approach to what it looks like for a student to have everything they need to succeed in life, and what does that look like, and what do we need to do to make sure that happens?
Right. Well, it's very different for the different students, the different demographics that make up the Ames Community School District. Obviously, we're known for having these all-star students who, you know, win at Quiz Bowl, win at Science Bowl, go on and compete in national events and, you know, make us proud. There's also, you know, largely, I guess, because we have such an educated group of parents, people working at Iowa State. But then, you know, we have folks whose parents or kids whose parents are cobbling together two or three jobs, part-time jobs, and struggling to make ends meet. And these, you know, students might find, you know, the science for, you know, English majors, the one that they want to take, you know, the easier version of things that relates to them where they are. How do you deal with all of those diverse populations?
That is the question of the day.
Okay.
Well, you know, a lot of things are converging, not just here in Ames, but everywhere. And I don't think there is a school district in the United States who is not facing some sort of an issue related to what you just spoke about in some way or another. Now, it's very different in each community, but the world has changed. We are not isolated communities anymore with homogeneous demographics.
Right.
Even in small towns in Iowa, that's not true anymore.
Right.
Everyone has been impacted by how mobile we are. Now, I say that in a positive way, and some people might say the other side of that is being transient, which means less stability. Then we all have access to information that comes from all over the world.
Right, so, through the internet.
Through the internet, right.
Facebook and so forth.
And other, you know, television, thing, other
right.
kinds of media. So we are all exposed to different ideas and different cultures. So what used to be the assumptions and the culture that used to work for everybody don't necessarily work as well as they used to.
But or maybe that were thought to work for everybody. Because there was some, there were problems. There's always been problems.
There's always been problems, but the problems weren't as obvious,
right.
I don't think,
yeah.
Or weren't as universally, people weren't experiencing them on such a level as we are now. Mm-hmm. But you know, I always have trouble when I approach things like this as problems, because I think they're the best opportunity we've ever had in the history of humankind, because of all the things that are coming together that give us the tools to address them. We've never had more opportunity than we do now. And I think we are becoming aware of that. We are becoming aware is what I say. We're not quite sure. And that's what we're working on strategically. What do we do now? Where can we find places where students are succeeding that we can take those practices and add them to the things we already know work for all students? We have to do what works for all students, and we have to figure out what else is needed beyond that for the students who need something different.
Yeah, and it might be just a big step. Part of this is recognizing the successes when they happen. It's really easy to recognize a winning Science Bowl team. They won the Science Bowl. You know, that's a success, and we can celebrate it. But when the successes are of a kind that are more subtle, that are some kind of internal transformation or just a baby step on this path, How do you celebrate those little successes? How do you pull them out and say, wow?
And that's exactly right, Greta. And those celebrations are going on, and the teachers can tell you about that. In fact, next month when I come, I'm bringing a group of students who are going to tell you in their words how they celebrate learning milestones and what it means in the process of learning. And you're going to be astounded, I think, at what they're able to say beyond their years about understanding how to learn. And this is a diverse group of students.
Mm-hmm. So that's the learning cycle that you're always talking about.
Yes, yes. And that's a common theme, because I want people to understand that we know so much more now about how people learn. And it's not just children, the way human beings learn.
Mm-hmm.
And what it takes to go through a whole cycle of learning, so that it's not just repeating data, it's understanding information so well that you can apply it in novel ways. So you're going to hear students talk about that. And, of course, that is different for each student. So what success means for a student who might not be the Science Bowl champion is just as much of a celebration as it is for that person. And in fact, sometimes even more of a celebration.
Right. Well, I mean, it sounds like the school culture has been kind of worked on. You know, you've been developing a school culture that recognizes these milestones in learning, and the students themselves are learning, you know, to pat themselves on the back for making these steps, for moving along through the learning cycle. But it might be the community, the people on the outside, who still need to find ways to recognize the people, the kids who are, you know, making their way and finding these new things. They don't make the headlines.
No, and if you think about what has been going on in Ames, let's say, it may be the last 10 years, would you agree? Because you and I have been in this community for a while, and through our other aspects of our lives, other community organizations and friendships we have, we've seen a lot of things change in Ames. And that's not necessarily always linear or neat and tidy, because people have to change their assumptions and they have to adapt and make room for new ideas and opportunities and struggles even and challenges. So the same thing is happening in the school district, because we are people. And what is so amazing to me is that at every level, the people who work in our district are very, very committed to making sure the students have the opportunity that they need. And they have very good support from administration to have the things in place that provide the framework and structure. And, of course, to make sure that what they're doing complies with all the external mandates and rules governing education, but within that they have a lot of freedom and a lot of support from their leadership teams, the professional learning communities, to explore innovative ways to approach this. So a lot of them are taking a good look at what they've already been given and reaching out across other districts, Iowa State University, taking classes and reading book studies to figure out what we need to do to make sure that these subgroups of students have access to what we call not just differentiated instruction, but even culturally proficient instruction, so that we understand that we all come to school with an identity, and some of those you can categorize as culture, but it all affects how we learn. And the vocabulary we use, the examples we use in lessons, and the opportunities we have for students to share should reflect those differences so that those students have a voice.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear that the district really has this orientation to such a degree. And so are you saying that, you know, there's a kind of setting aside of that standardized test model of evaluating success at a school-wide and district-wide level and saying, well, we're going to develop other metrics for how we measure our success, what we're doing right? It's not going to be necessarily always reflected in the standardized test results.
No, we can't set them aside.
Okay.
We must, by federal and state guidelines, administer standardized tests. So we will keep doing that. And they do have their place. They do provide information that helps us go back and evaluate high-level programming in the district and each building. But there are other things we do along the way, and it's due to the learning cycle. Because we are checking in, I talked to the students the other day, and they call it a quick check. You know, every day there's a quick check to see if they learned what was the goal for that day. And then there are more formal interim benchmarking kind of test, and then you have the standardized test, which we call summative in academic terms, mm-hmm. to see, okay, at the end of this, can we measure what was learned here? But for our own internal qualitative assessment of ourselves, we want to make sure we have a more robust definition of what success looks like so that we're not averaging things out, because things always are way above average in AIMS. But as you know, averages don't tell the whole story.
Right. And so as I just want to work in this part, you're the director of school community and media relations. So what is the message to the community when it comes to evaluating progress and nurturing young students coming through the system?
I think a really important message is that we are all in the midst of a transformation, I believe, in the way we appreciate diversity, not just because we appreciate differences, but we appreciate the strengths that come from that. You know, if you think of working in a group, and if everybody in the group had the same skills, you would have a very flat outcome. Society is the same way.
And it would be very competitive. Everybody would be trying to fit the same niche.
And maybe that's why we are so competitive now, because that's what
we've had a single cookie-cutter model.
Mm-hmm, right. But if we can look at what each segment or each component of our community has to offer and celebrate and use that contribution and then accept where we don't have a strength or a skill ourselves, recognize that each person has strengths and each person has areas where they need to accept help, then we'll be more cohesive as a society and more collaborative and less competitive, and we'll give more people a chance to have what they need. You know, and can I say, everyone needs a chance to have purpose, resources, and relationships in their life, right?
Right. Yes. And a sense of contributing.
Right. Reciprocity at the very least.
Right. So this is infusing throughout the school district. And how do you go about communicating to teachers this, you know, how do you tell teachers to behave differently or change or foster this kind of attitude?
Do you know what peer pressure is, right? No, we have a lot of collaboration in the district and professional learning communities. So their peers are so, you know, a lot of teachers are so excited about the baby steps they're taking that they are building into what we're already doing that's working really well for the learning cycle. So that enthusiasm is going to catch on. So in another way of saying it in academic terms, some teachers are modeling what works and getting other teachers excited. And there's nothing that has been mandated by the administration yet. Like I said, the board goals are still a work in progress, but we are taking this approach of experimenting, exploring, gathering our data, and looking at what is working as we move forward to see what will be effective and what we need to build into our longer-term strategies.
Can you just provide me, or listeners, one example of a model teacher or a model unit segment that has caught other teachers' attention and helped move this goal forward?
I can tell you a story that a school counselor told me this week, and one building has its building goal to teach cultural proficiency. So I would say each of our schools has something innovative that they are working on that they're going to be able to share out across the district. One building, and they'll come in and talk to us over the course of the year, has a building goal of cultural proficiency.
That's fascinating. It's not just the students. It's also the teachers learning cultural proficiency.
And it's the principal's leadership that's going to make sure that this gets done this year. But an example of how this affects a student is that at the beginning of the year, a kindergarten student would not do the morning activity of giving a firm handshake and looking the teacher in the eye. Can you guess why?
I'm sure that student came from a culture where that is disrespectful or threatening.
Yes, and that student was, as a kindergartner, so upset and had no way of communicating in words how uncomfortable that was. So, of course, the student cried and had a little temper tantrum because it was a kindergarten student starting school. So when the counselor became aware of this and knew the culture from which this student came, she was able to say, oh, let's try this. And that's just an example. The student can now come into school, start his day with respect for the school community and yet respect for his culture as he learns what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable and is able to start learning right away instead of being completely distraught.
Oh, wow. So is the goal, and the goal is not strictly assimilation, I would assume.
Absolutely not.
It is to also learn what rituals of respect go on in his culture.
Right.
Well, that's very interesting. Okay. Well, Kathy, I think we are nearly out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to say about this initiative that it sounds like, you know, some of the goals are, you know, inclusiveness, like you said, cultural proficiency and collaboration. We haven't talked much
right.
about that. And are there collaborations among teachers within a school, for instance, doing, I know there is at the high school level, there has been. I'm afraid that program was discontinued, the Blue STEM Institute. We did a lot with them last year with the seniors who are learning environmental issues and communication, you know, kinds of ways of communicating and so on. But at the elementary level, are there any of those types of collaborations among teachers and to help kind of put all this subject matter, you know, in a way that's not a box, but it
right.
spreads out?
Yes, there are. In fact, most of instruction is not to the level of the Blue STEM Institute, but to some degree, because the teachers are always working together. And they even, like if you have 3 fifth grade classes in a building, those teachers pretty much share those students. I mean, they have the rooms and they have their times in their classrooms, but there's so much group-based learning and project-based learning, excuse me, I'm getting hoarse, that goes on where the students are being put in different groups with different classes all the time and working on projects. When they go to art, music, and PE, they're taking components of that into those lessons, and those teachers are working with the other core teachers to make sure that everybody has the resources they need. And one thing that's really helped that at the elementary level is the fact that students have their own computers at school now. They don't get to take them home, but they have them at school, so they always have access to whatever they've been doing. It's not waiting for the computer lab or waiting for somebody else to get done with the computer, so that project-based collaboration has really freed them up for more continuity beyond that literacy block or that social studies block or what we call fine arts or specials. So all of that is working together now. But the main change, I think, is because the teachers are collaborating, it opens up that opportunity for lessons to be coordinated among the disciplines in a way that we didn't have before.
Right. And I can see the learning cycle as
yes.
integral to that
yes.
because, you know, in order to apply the knowledge, you need to have an opportunity to apply it. And if you, you know, when the bell rings, you switch gears and go to something completely mm-hmm. different, then you wouldn't have that
so
opportunity.
Just, I know we probably need to wind up, but there's one thing I want the community to know is that we are not really so different. We are part of this community. And those boundaries can be so fluid because most of us live here and have lives here. Some of the people in the district don't, but most of us are part of this community. And I think we're all facing the similar opportunities. I'm not going to call them challenges. I'm going to call them opportunities. So I really hope that we can figure out ways to engage with each other and understand each other and find the common resources we have together. And people need to understand some of the constraints that school districts have that prevent us from doing this, the things the same way the community can. But if we are working together and building that level of common goals and trust, I think that we can come a long way for addressing these challenges. And it won't just help students. It will help families. It will help businesses. It will help neighborhoods. I really think we have a tremendous opportunity to help each other here.
And for the listener who thinks, wow, I would really like to be part of this. I would like to come into the schools and volunteer, see this work in action, contribute my role as listener and guider and this and that. Is that still an option for people? Are there opportunities for people to volunteer?
There are opportunities, and the best way to find out what they are is to maybe contact the principal of your school that's closest to your neighborhood and see what opportunities match your talents and skills. Otherwise, we really want people to be observing our school board meetings. We have school board committee meetings that we post on our website. But also, just be involved in your neighborhood. Be alert to families and get to know families in your neighborhood. Be involved and engaged that way, because when students exit our doors, they're the communities again, completely right. And wholly. So we really need that kind of support as well. But if anyone wants to come and talk about opportunities, it's hard to do it in a segment like this. Make an appointment with me. We'll go have coffee. I'll tell you of some of the other things that are going on. And maybe we can have some other conversations about where different organizations, neighborhoods, and individuals can engage.
Well, that's wonderful. Kathy Hansen, Director of School Community and Media Relations for the Ames Community School District. Always a pleasure, Kathy.
Thank you, Greta. I'm looking forward to bringing some guests to your program over the next months. And like I said, next month we will have some students from Edwards Elementary School who are going to tell you about the learning cycle in their own words.
Great. Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Let food be thy medicine. This is a quote attributed to Hippocrates approximately 2,400 years ago, and it was selected by the World Food Prize Committee to describe the four laureates being honored this weekend in Des Moines. That is because three of these plant scientists, Maria Andrade and Robert Mwanga of Mozambique and Uganda, Jean Lowe, also working in Africa, developed the orange-fleshed sweet potato, which is rich in nutrients, particularly beta-carotene, compared to the native variety of sweet potato, and convinced the African households to plant, purchase, and consume this new crop or modified crop. The fourth World Food Prize laureate, Howard Boas, also set out this agenda of biofortification on an institutional level. My question, though, to our next guest is biofortification always a good thing? Are all biofortified crops born equal? I've invited Cornelia Flora, Professor Emeritus of the ISU Rural Sociology Department, to explore the pros and cons of biofortification, a topic she has been working on. Also on the phone, we have an ISU graduate student in sociology, Nabath Wambali, who worked in a group to implement the orange-fleshed sweet potato in his home country of Uganda. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's really nice to be here and to talk about the possibilities and pitfalls of biofortification in existing foods.
And so for a working definition of biofortification, this is the introduction of desired nutritional components to a crop, usually already the staple crop of a country.
Right. And what scientists are learning is this is not just inserting a gene and having it increased nutrient value that can be absorbed by the human body, as we've learned in the whole golden rice fracasso. It was a good idea, one assumes, but it turns out that there's not that much beta-carotene that can be absorbed by nutrient-poor, particularly people with low fat in their diet, as fat as necessary to absorb vitamin A. And it's not so great to grow. It doesn't yield very well. And as friends of mine who worked in the CGIAR system, that's the International Research Institutions, it turns out that it shatters. So when poor women harvest the rice, the heads fall off, it's very difficult to haul, and so when you pound it, you just break it all up. And the fourth part of it that was a problem was it was all done with short grain rice, which is what we use in the United States and Europe, and that doesn't grow well in Asia and parts of Africa where they use long grain rice. So there are a whole series of unawareness. There was a huge awareness and concern for malnutrition and vitamin A blindness, but not much understanding of the reality of poor people's lives in developing countries. The sweet potato is a little bit different. The sweet potato that is being introduced is introduced in diverse gardens where you are growing carrots and tomatoes and other vegetables that can also be consumed. So the sweet potato is development is done and its implementation is done as part of a diverse diet where you're more likely to be able to absorb the vitamin A. And the way most vitamin deficiencies are treated is by having a very diverse diet.
Okay. And we'll get to you, Nabath, in a second. I want to ask you, but to clarify, the golden rice was used the GMO technology where you insert a gene. But the sweet potato, the case of the orange flesh sweet potato, that was just a matter of traditional, conventional breeding. Is that correct?
My understanding is that that was conventional breeding, but it was very much informed by DNA technology. In other words, to be able to look at the DNA of plants in order to know how to do the crosses appropriately.
Okay. Nabath, does what Professor Flora said ring a bell? Is that the case? truly, in Uganda, where you worked with this orange flesh sweet potato.
Yes, I want to first correct the statement you just made. I worked with an organization that frontiered the promotion and dissemination of knowledge as well as the materials of orange sweet potato, flesh, sweet potatoes within rural communities of Uganda. Yes, she's very right. With the sweet potatoes, it's basically using the conventional or what we'd consider traditional plant breeding methods in which there is a crossover pollen from the male sweet potato materials to the females by the scientists themselves without necessarily involving transgenic transfer of these materials like it's done with the GMOs. So, yes, it is something that was done using conventional methods. And, again, like Professor saying, it's something that involves the diverse food system of the local communities. And that's what has made it a success.
And when we spoke last night, you also mentioned that the process of developing this special sweet potato was done in collaboration with local people. Is that correct? And what kind of local people were involved?
So in this, what I'm trying to say, you know, because of the experiences that had existed elsewhere with the golden rice.
Right.
Communities were a little bit suspicious of what kind of product that is being brought within their communities. And so this whole process has involved two phases. The first phase was to really enlighten the communities on what is an orange sweet flesh potato variety. And how is it being produced? So this involved bringing scientists on board that were Ugandans, that were involved in the breeding programs, and then the farmers that were the targeted beneficiaries of this from the rural communities were being involved in trying to show them how exactly these varieties are being produced at the research stations and how it is not involving any GMO technology. And as a result of that, it became much more easier for the farmers to really understand the concept behind the breeding of the varieties and how actually they have had their input into the breeding of these varieties in a sense that once the first varieties were released and given to the farmers to test them and looking at the test of the cooked varieties that were there, they had some concerns that they gave feedback to the scientists. And over time, we've seen an improvement in these varieties to suit the test and to suit the interests of the farmers that has actually made it more of a success in the second phase.
So you're saying there was some feedback among the consumers and farmers about what worked for them, and the scientists listened to that feedback and develop the crop accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
This is really important. This is called participatory plant breeding, and it means that it's this interplay between the users, and it wasn't just the farmers. It was also the people cooking and eating.
Right, the taste of the
that were involved. And I think this is really important, which didn't occur, unfortunately, with the golden rice work. But many of the CGAIRs, the International Agriculture Research Institutes, particularly SIAT, which is based in Colombia, and SEEP, which is the International Potato Center, which was the leading institution on the golden sweet potato, no, sorry, orange flesh sweet potato, were very aware of the importance of the end user, the farmer, and the processor and consumer of the sweet potato, which made a huge difference in their ability to take this out. And The other piece that is important is that a sweet potato is root propagated. So this is something that then the farmers themselves can control and share.
Take ownership of.
And take ownership of. Literally ownership, as opposed to having this owned by a private corporation whose, our Supreme Court has said, whose only duty is to give profits to its shareholders. So this is a very different model,
right,
of using plant breeding, a really felt need, and doing it within an existing diverse cropping system.
Wow. It's been a while since I read the biography of Norman Borlaug, maybe 20 years, but I do recall that he had a similar kind of process with the wheat breeding that he did in Mexico. At first he thought, oh, I'm gonna breed this great wheat and give it to them, and you know, they'll just all love it. And of course they didn't. It was too different. And so he found out that the most important part of the process was this feedback from the farmers, so that they could work together to build, create something that was acceptable.
Yes, I think this is an often forgotten strength of Borlaug's methodology, which is we're paying attention to who is going to implement this technology. I'm just not going to sell it to a seed dealer and hope that seed dealer then convinces someone to buy it, or they'll buy it because it's the only thing that's there. So this is really important to remember when we're talking about any improvement in a crop.
Right. And, of course, Norman Borlaug is the was the founder of the World Food Prize, which we are discussing right now. Naboth, are you still with us?
Yes, please.
Oh, I'm afraid that I've made you late for your bus. But I wanted to just bring up the issue of the banana, because that's when I first met you. The beta-carotene-enriched banana that's being tested for its effects on consumers here at Iowa State University through the Department of Human Sciences. And you spoke on a panel about this transgenic banana. Where does it fall in this continuum of golden rice versus, as a bad example, versus sweet potato, as the orange-fleshed sweet potato, as a very good example of biofortification?
You know, if you can recall very well, my argument about the transgenic bananas, again, was on the concept of saying, yes, you're coming up with this very nice product, which is very rich in vitamin A. But to what extent have you involved the consumers of the product? And so looking at it from the social aspect, like you're saying with the sweet orange fleshed potatoes, involve the end use of the product to make suggestions as to whether this is something that they feel is viable, and then also the concern about who then owns the the patents to this product. Orange sweet potatoes have been a success, again, based on the fact that the farmers are able to multiply the materials and able to use them without any costs or strings attached. The beauty with them is the fact that, again, Mother Nature, once they've come up with a variety that are very rich in vitamin A, Mother Nature takes its role to multiply these planting materials through the use of the beneficial insects that we very much know, which are the bees. And so there's no worry as to whether this variety is going to be really so much wiped out unless it's so much hit by the diseases. And so that was the concern I was having the bananas, to say, to what extent have you involved the end users to come up with this idea?
I want to add something to that, because they're saying that this is to help the really, really malnourished. And the early studies, this one successful study, nutritional study of golden rice to show vitamin A absorption from it was on a very well-nourished population, which had the fat in their diet to absorb vitamin A. And I don't know what animal trials were done with the banana, but I know what you would show in terms of vitamin A uptake with well-nourished populations.
Such as ISU undergrads.
Such as ISU undergrads. We're assuming they are eating well, although they probably, I don't mean to demean them, but probably have too many carbohydrates in their diet already, but that this will not really, I suppose it would tell you if they drop dead or something, which we assume would not happen, but it doesn't tell you, it tells you if there is some absorption, but it doesn't tell you what it will do with malnourished populations.
Hmm. And another comment that you made at the forum, Naboth, was about how the company that was breeding this banana or manufacturing this new banana was solving problems that the agricultural problems that to some extent the local farmers had already solved with their own methods.
Yeah, so I'm not an expert very well on it, but the history about the transgenic banana is that it involves one of the genes that is being used is a gene that is being extracted from, I think it's a pepper variety.
Pepper.
Mm-hmm. Either it's a hot pepper, sweet pepper variety.
Uh-huh.
And from the experience of the farmers that were that actually farming with the bananas, they've had the challenge of some of the very notorious diseases that attack the bananas and make them more vulnerable to disease and getting to almost wiping them out of their food systems. And so the challenge with that was that, okay, how best can we get a banana variety that is so rich in vitamin A but also is resistant to some of the diseases that exist? And so they use this gene that is extracted from the peppers. But then we find that in the local food systems, again, for the farmers that have been growing the bananas over time, they use pepper extracts from the indigenous or traditional peppers and mix that with animal excreta, and in this case, urine, at times even using human urine in itself. And they use this concoction together to really help and apply to their bananas that are susceptible or are getting diseased with the banana bacterial wilt, which is a very notorious disease. To the extent that I know the efficacy levels of that, I'll be honestly a liar to give figures on that. But we've seen them and we've had testimonies from these farmers saying that, yes, it works only if detection is made early and control measures put in place.
So,
but to what extent that is successful to really come up and say these are the figures, I'd be honestly lying to you.
There's another issue there as well, is if you have a treatment such as BT, which is used by organic farmers, which you use only when you see the symptoms of a disease, how different is that when you breed it into the plant and it's always there, thus encouraging the survival only of the pests that resist that particular pesticide? So this notion of setting up one generation of resistance and then a huge survival of the fittest pests that can then attack and be resistant to what is already in that particular banana. Whereas the farmers who were using the eyes on the ground to apply it when they saw the pest really made a huge difference.
And it makes a great story, too. All you have to do is take the extract of the pepper and mix it with some urine and spray it when necessary. Such a simple solution. Well, Naboth, I will let you go. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Naboth let's see, how do I pronounce your name?
Naboth Mwambali.
Mwambali. and a sociologist or studying sociology as a graduate student from Uganda, used to work with an organization that propagated the sweet orange flesh sweet potato.
It promoted.
Promoted, not propagated.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Cornelia, some last words about this issue as it is part of the World Food Prize this year, so central to the awardees.
Well, I'm actually very pleased that the orange flesh sweet potato, OPSP.
OFPS.
Was chosen precisely because of the way it was developed, that this is using traditional plant breeding. It is using participatory plant breeding. It is introduced using scientists on the ground in the countries where it is to be used, is a very exciting innovation. And I hope we can learn from it that it is better to work in integrated systems and include the human factors that really are going to make something either utilized or not. So I think that some people do not understand that this was something derived with traditional plant breeding.
And I myself was among their number.
And so I think this is a really important piece to defend our traditional plant breeders, that no one will own this germplasm, that the farmers will be able to reproduce it without buying new seeds, without buying new roots, and that it is part of an integrated farming system which will help it resist pests when it is grown with a wide variety of other vegetables and grains.
Yeah, Vic Moss, who has recently left the role as director of Emergency Residence Project after 29 years of service, told me once, "You just can't get rich helping the poor." And I think that, you know, maybe our food, well, I'll just leave it at that.
But you can gain incredible sense of joy in knowing that people are becoming more self-sufficient, that you have increased their self-respect because you have paid attention and responded to their insights.
Well, very well said, Cornelia Flora. A sociologist who's worked with many indigenous groups. I know in South America with potatoes, the regular potatoes, although they're not regular, they're very unique and interesting, and agricultural systems. Thank you so much for joining us, Cornelia. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started the show with the Director of School, Community, and Media Relations for the Ames Community School District, Kathy Hansen. We continued with a conversation with Cornelia Flora and Naboth Mumbawa from Uganda about the issue of biofortification, which is in the spotlight this weekend at the World Food Prize proceedings in Des Moines. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Vince Valeriano. And our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Riches from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was by the Swedish pop group Vartina. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join us as our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting the Havana Cuba All-Stars on their debut tour of the United States with a program of songs and music celebrating the musical legacy of Cuba. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.